Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, protests are planned ahead of the G20 and the JMPD says it is on high alert. New data shows South Africa's middle class is becoming more financially disciplined. Inside South Africa's first digital ecosystem for equine insurance, and two South African entrepreneurs are turning data and creativity into a global growth story. It's Wednesday, the 12th of November. South Africans are being warned of a possible national shutdown next week, just as Johannesburg prepares to host world leaders for the G20 summit. Civil society groups are calling for a stay away and nationwide demonstrations to highlight government failures and social grievances, raising concerns about traffic chaos, safety and disruption to business and essential services. The Johannesburg Metropolitan Police Department says it is on high alert. And in that respect, I'm joined now by Superintendent Xolani Fihla, who is going to discuss the city's readiness and what residents might expect. Superintendent, welcome. And how credible is this shutdown threat, in your opinion? Do you have intelligence, perhaps, about the scale and coordination of something like this?
Good afternoon to you, Jeremy, and let me greet the listeners. When it comes to this specific one, when it does mention the national shutdown on the 21st, with the information we are gathering that there is a possibility of major disruptions, not only in the city of Johannesburg, but across the province and even possibly the country. But as you did mention, that we are on high alert for any possible either protests or pickets that's either planned or unplanned. We know that within that same weekend, we are going into the G20 Leader Summit happening on the 22nd and 23rd. And with that, then plans have been put in place for us to mitigate any unplanned protests. But we've also have received notifications of planned protests and pickets around the city of Johannesburg and particularly in the Nasrec area.
Are you able to share specific plans that are in place to prevent, for instance, highways and city routes from being blocked?
Of course, with planned protests or pickets, then there is discussions between the convener and authorities, as the South African Police Services and the JMPD, on the movement of either the protesters or the picketers and where they'll be stationed. And with that, then we have put in mitigating plans to ensure that we don't disrupt major routes and also don't disrupt the summit as well. But of course, then with unplanned protests, then with us monitoring, we have to analyze the situation and if needs be, then have to move people to a safer area where they can picket or protest.
The G20 summit itself obviously brings global attention to Johannesburg and huge logistical challenges for any organization. It's going to be difficult, I would imagine, for you to manage protests on the one hand if they occur and the event itself simultaneously without overstretching your resources.
And definitely that has also been a thought for all the organizers. And this is definitely an event of national importance. So it's not only the responsibility of the JMPD or authorities within the city of Johannesburg alone. We've got many stakeholders from the national and the provincial level. And with that, and especially when it comes to law enforcement, we do have force multipliers from the various law enforcement agencies to ensure that we do cover aspects such as protests.
Your challenge, of course, is to balance the right to protest with the need to maintain public order and protect property, and obviously a guarantee that your officers are not going to overextend themselves.
True, that is definitely a guarantee. We do know that in South Africa, the right to protest peacefully is protected by the Constitution. And of course, we need to act within the laws and regulations that have been put in place to ensure that protests are peaceful. If it is peaceful, then for us, it's just to monitor and ensure that it doesn't disrupt the freedom of any other person who's not involved in the protest, and ensure that everything does run smoothly.
What assurance can you give businesses who would naturally be worried about disruptions and looting?
We can give assurance that we are aware, firstly, of planned protests, but also with intelligence gathering from the relevant authorities, and especially the South African Police Services, ensuring that those that are planned are unplanned. We do keep an eye out and an ear on the ground, and that we do mitigate and attend to them when there is a need. And of course, we do know that heading towards that weekend of the G20 summit, there will be significant disruptions across the city of Johannesburg, but particularly in the area of Nasrec and in Sandton as well. So businesses and individuals and normal citizens should be aware of those, disruptions and plan accordingly. And of course, we'll be releasing further information if there is any further road closures or any other disruptions, then the members of the public will be made aware.
How are you doing that in terms of real-time information about road closures, protest routes and safe travel zones?
That definitely is in partnership with the media, and ensuring that whatever messages is sent out promptly, that the public can be aware, but also just encouraging the public to listen to your radio, watch the TV, and also watch the social media platforms, and that's where all this information will be shared. But also what is important, that we do have community engagements, and especially in areas that we do know that there will be significant disruptions, especially due to the leader summit, then they are advised prior, and that they can plan whatever they need to do beforehand.
As far as the protest organizers are concerned, are you able to tell me whether you have engaged with them or they've engaged with you? And if that's happened, are you satisfied with their cooperation?
Is this for the 21st national shutdown, or just all the other planned protests within the
city? Guess, Superintendent, my question would apply to both.
Okay. For the planned protests that we do have, have received notices, of course, as I did mention, that there's meetings with the convener to plan either routes or places where they will picket, so that there is a plan for. But with the national shutdown that we have been seeing going around through social media, is that we haven't received any formal notification regarding that, but we will keep an ear and eye out, and if it does do happen, then we will attend to it accordingly.
Would Johannesburg be possibly preparing to bring in support from other metros?
Definitely. Specifically heading towards the G20, and with the summit happening, we have drawn in many resources, as I did mention before. It's on a national and a provincial level. So we do have cooperations with the Ekurhuleni and Tshwane Metro Police, but not only them as well, with the Road Traffic Management Corporation, that's the RTMC, and the Gauteng Traffic Police, and of course the South African Police Services.
It's going to be a very busy couple of days in this November. Superintendent Xolani Fihla, thank you very much indeed for talking to me from the Johannesburg Metropolitan Police Department.
MoneyWeb at midday. Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, it's interesting to note that South Africa's middle class is getting financially sharper, it's getting more digital and more disciplined. That's the message from new FNB Premier data released as the bank marks its 25th anniversary. FNB says this group has shifted from cash-reliant to tech-savvy, from reactive to proactive, and is using digital tools to build confidence even in tough economic conditions. So let's dive into this story with Garth Keshwa, who's head of personal core banking product at FNB. Garth, a very warm welcome to you. What's the single biggest behavioral shift then that is shaping the middle class right now, and why does it matter for the wider economy?
From what we're seeing, we see that the middle income class is looking to shift their behavior. I think in the past you'd see it moving from being highly cash reliant and branch interactions to that more of digital. Essentially, we've seen it move, I think, about to 90% of the customers are now banking digitally, and primarily around 81% of our customers are using the FNB app predominantly towards their banking. And this speaks to a multiple facet of items. You would note that they would look at actually reducing their sort of complexity around what they're looking to do. Customers have more visibility and control about how they interact with their banking and their financial needs. They have personal insights, and they get a better fundamental view around security, which actually assists them within their journey.
So if that's the case then, and digital banking is now the default, which is not unexpected, what then, Garth, does it tell us about financial confidence versus financial stress that so many people are facing right now?
I think when we look at it and we see our middle income earners, we see what is known as the middle sandwich or vanishing effect that is basically spoken about a lot. And this stems to essentially like three quadrants that make up the necessary behaviors. You would see customers that have low or little fluctuation within their income. You would then see a higher level of commitments from a debt perspective. And the third item that comes into play is around the necessary behavioral commitments. So they have commitments to extended family members, they have commitments to necessary communities, to all of these facets that come into play around what drives that. And that ultimately leads to them having less disposable income. And with the drive to digital, you find that if a customer utilizes the necessary tools that are available, essentially, you know, we have tools like our Nav Money, which allows you to budget smarter. You can actually underpin what your expenses are, set budgets for your necessary day-to-day items like your groceries, your fuel, let's call it your internet or your connectivity. All of these items actually result in a customer that is better equipped to handle, you know, the necessary financial journeys that they go upon. It also helps them have a lower default risk and a stronger long-term wealth growth further down the line.
So the middle class isn't necessarily, if I'm hearing you correctly, becoming financially healthier. Maybe they're just more adaptive under pressure. Is that a fair interpretation?
Absolutely. I would say resilience and adaptability. And this really comes into fold in terms of what we provide as solutions and offerings, because this actually supports them within their journey. If you take a look at it as well, customers then also say that they want to look at how they get the most out of, as an example, their necessary rewards and actually get cash back into their pockets to help them during this time where they might be struggling. And if we look at and we take a little bit of a view back on Premier, I think we started in the year 2000, 25 years, and going strong. And what we found is that we have paid out essentially $5 billion in e-bucks since the year 2000. And that's on lines of items, which is your necessities around fuel and grocer, I think, which makes up about 76% of the earn over the last 25 years. But then it's a bit of a dichotomy, because you also see the spend coming into play around e-bucks being spent on items which include lifestyle items, necessarily your travel, your beauty and health products, all of those coming into foot. I think we've seen roughly about 35 million redeemed in travel discounts, and roughly around 117,000 in the last year was utilized for your necessary slow lounge visits, and 50,000 for flight bookings. So yeah, a bit of a dichotomy, but customers are behaving in the correct manners.
So what do you see as the next big risk or vulnerability that this group is going to face, and how prepared is the banking sector for that?
I think the next risk that this group might face might come from, it's going to be possibly maybe your volatility around interests and investments. So customers that have placed a lot of their funds within investments and assets might see a bit of a shakeup there coming into play. And then one of the things that would be interesting, not necessarily a risk, I think, or to see the future of artificial intelligence and how that comes into play.
So, Garth, just a final one then. Looking ahead then, is there a single innovation or approach then that's maybe going to best transform personal banking for the next generation, which has a whole different set of priorities and a markedly different approach to life?
Sure. Jeremy, I think if I had to look at it, one of the greatest things I'd say that would come along the way is going to be partnerships. So, number one, we have to look at how we partner with the necessary fintechs in order to get that necessary, niche of whatever might be offered to solve for the customer. And then also look at how we partner with our customers upon their journeys to make sure that they get that, sustainable growth within their tracking. I think we had a conversation around this last week sometime because the question was phased around customers go through this life cycle journey. And you want to make sure that they are prepared and necessarily ready for what comes within the ecosystem of the bank. And roughly about 41% of our premier customers actually move on to private banking. And I think when they move on to private banking, they have that necessary view where their banking gets a little bit more complex. It's more of an intricate view of their balance sheet that's required, more of a private banker to come into play to help them with actually growing their wealth. And that's, where I see it going.
Garth Keshwa, thank you very much indeed. Head of Personal Core Banking Product at FNB. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now let's move on to this. And Entrepreneurship Month is a reminder, I think, that South Africa's economic future is not going to be shaped only by policy and markets, but also founders, entrepreneurs who spot shifts early. And one of the more exciting examples is the rise of commerce media. It's a sector valued, I'm told, at something like 4 billion rand. And behind the shift are entrepreneurs like Daniel Levy and Gil Sperling. And Gil joins us now to explore what it takes to stay ahead of the curve. It's something that all entrepreneurs want, and why innovation increasingly begins at home. His company Flow is a commerce media platform that is revolutionizing how retailers, e-commerce platforms, and marketplaces and brands use audience data. Gil, welcome to you. And entrepreneurship, as I've just mentioned, is often about spotting the next shift before others do. Based on your experience, how does one train oneself to see that kind of opportunity as early as possible?
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. Sure, I would call it the Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours. So my and Daniel's background is ad tech. We've been doing this for almost 20 years. We were the founders of a previous business, Popeye Media, which was the first to kind of bring through and ride the back of the growth of Facebook's media in this on the continent. Actually, we became Facebook's partner in Africa as a marketing partner, and so that really is where we cut our teeth, and that's our DNA. So with that, I'm always kind of monitoring and sensitive to the trends, and commerce media is the latest shift and the fastest growing, actually. And so we're there trying to facilitate it.
Gil, commerce media, as I understand it, didn't even exist as a category in South Africa a few years ago. I'm interested to know what
Right.
convinced you that this was the next big bold frontier.
There's a few reasons. I mean, firstly, when we monitored the trends, it was fast growing in the States with Amazon leading it. And the idea behind it probably would make sense as to why it has become what it is. And that's because commerce media is really where you're able to target first-party data or shopper data. So, for example, take Amazon. A seller on Amazon is able to target people who have shopped on Amazon before and bought a certain product and target them with their product, bringing them back to their site for conversion. And that creates a far higher return on investment because you can imagine how relevant that advertising is, and therefore why it has caught on, because it really provides a return on investment for advertisers and a better user experience for consumers because of the relevance.
The sector is, of course, changing all the time. It moves with the speed of light, if not faster. How do you stay ahead of the trends then to make sure that you are both relevant and also profitable?
Listening to the market and understanding the pains, because when we do follow the trends, because we follow them globally where we can, and we attend conferences in other leading regions and talk to leading CMOs or from global brands. But ultimately, we bring back what we understand the market wants and where we see relevance and understanding the nuance in the market. So it's probably the mesh of exposing ourselves globally and just listening to what the market needs.
And how do you sift out good ideas from bad ideas?
I guess part of the entrepreneurial journey is somewhat a gut that's been pre-programmed with the 10,000 hours and also experiments. So when we do bring out a product, it is as informed as can be from just an understanding, from listening to the market, but also experimenting and seeing how people use it. And so that iterative approach is what allows us to move quite in an agile way and keep sharpening our product and challenging it.
Agility means timing. And Gil, many great ideas fail not because of product issues, I think, but because founders misread the timing. In your case, how do you or did you know that the market was ready for the offering that you were providing? And how do you know when to pivot into something new?
So one of the things that kind of supported what we do is just watching the shift, the technological shift of browsing the web, which has come in the form of regulation, of dropping deprecating the third party cookie. And that shift meant that it necessitated something. Right. So that's one of the top signals that we've kept on following. And a lot of our product is out of necessity. And that's where the pieces kind of came together, the piece of the puzzle.
In this fascinating journey and successful journey, what's the single biggest mistake that you've made and how did you recover?
there are lots of mistakes.
Pick one, Gil.
Flow actually started as a completely different business.
Yeah.
We wanted to revolutionize property rental. I still think it's a very, very archaic, there's so much to innovate. It's the least innovated sector. And we had a lot of great ideas. And it was really COVID where we pivoted the business because the dynamics changed. And we learned through our experience in the property world that there's actually also a deep marketing need for and how data plays a part in it. So that was a learning that was, it was painful, but it was a learning that we took to heart and did something about. And that was probably one of the biggest shifts and pivots that we had.
Gil, every Monday on this program, we talk to a single entrepreneur. And it's interesting that you have referenced your partner, Daniel. I'm interested to know how entrepreneurs manage the relationship with a co-founder. I'm assuming that it's actually a good thing to argue and to have a vociferous difference of opinion.
Definitely, as long as it's constructive. And I think what's the most important and the part that is not questionable between us is just the value system. And so we may come with different opinions, different views, even different experiences because we both have a different skill set. But ultimately, the choices that we make, we trust each other because we have the same value system of envision and direction of what we want to do.
And just a quick answer.
Foundation.
Is there any advice that you would have for South African founders such as yourselves trying to build a globally relevant business as you've done from a local base?
I think aim for the stars because there's some incredible talent in South Africa. And I've had the opportunity to travel and meet other founders and comparatively, we've got some incredible people in South Africa and there's no reason why you can't build a global business. So I think that often entrepreneurs perhaps are a bit, there's an unknown and perhaps somewhat intimidated and starry-eyed about what they read. I think that South African entrepreneurs can aim for the stars.
Gil Sperling, thank you very much indeed, and good luck with the rest of your
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, there's an interesting digital shakeup that is happening in one of South Africa's most traditional spaces, the stables. Consult by Momentum Bosch Corp has launched something called GiddyUp. It's the country's first digital ecosystem for horse owners. Now, as far as I understand it, it's a platform that fuses equine wellness, insurance, event management, and a global horse-loving community, and all inspired by one man's childhood bond with his horse princess. Well, I think that man is Johan Roux, who is franchise principal. Johan, we're going to have to start this conversation by you telling us who Princess was, or is.
Thanks, Jeremy. I appreciate that. At a very young age, about 12 years old, I had an encounter with a horse named Princess. And that took me back to a very deep connection with horses. I think we all would agree that horses has got healing powers. And not only that, a bond that you form with horses is far deeper than any other animal you can ever experience.
So you now believe that the market in 2025 is ready for digital disruption. Johan, the equestrian center is often seen as niche and conservative. What's changed your thinking in this respect?
Jeremy, I would say that specifically in the equestrian market with horses, this is needed. A platform to bring everything together in terms of the sporting events, as well as the insurance arena. This would make it much more easier for horse owners and the events they do, as well as the vets and the track record for the horse's wellness.
Johan, just tell me as a matter of interest, how big and influential this equestrian community is in South Africa?
It is by far one of the biggest industries in South Africa. We are looking across the polo cross. We are talking about your endurance rides, your equestrian rides, as well as a lot of schools that is currently doing horse riding activities after hours as a sporting event. I do think that this will change the whole equestrian market, as well as ease of use for that animal that they love so very much.
So this is a digital ecosystem, but I would suggest to you, Johan, that systems like this can be expensive to build and maintain. So a sort of a multi-pronged question here. Explain to me exactly how it works and what sort of investment went into it in order to make it financially sustainable and cost-effective going forward.
Look, Jeremy, the thing is, it started 5 years ago and it is quite expensive to have brought it to the launch stage. I do think that the tool that is a management tool that will bring trainers, owners, as well as vets together in one platform will make it much easier and also will reform the future of the equestrian horse industry by being effective, bringing down insurance costs and regulate veterinary expenses. With all due respect, currently veterinary expenses are not well regulated and costs are determined as and when.
Johan, explain to me how pricing is going to work for users. Is it a subscription model or would the cost be built into the products themselves? And also, it's going to be difficult to avoid excluding smaller owners or emerging riders, surely?
Absolutely the truth. So on GiddyUp, there is a subscription for horses and for riders. Your first horse will be 89 rand a month. If you do own more than one horse, the second horse thereafter is 59 rand a month. For each rider, Jeremy, it will be 10 rand. As you well know, that horses gets leased for specific events, and you would like to know which rider is on the horse. And also for event coordinators can now integrate with our app to do it and to make it for them way more advanced and for the events to be tracked.
And Johan, I'm assuming the platform would hold sensitive data. I'm thinking medical records, insurance details, event information. Critical that you reassure people that you're managing cybersecurity and privacy in what I think would be a high trust community.
Absolutely. We do that. No information will be shared on the platform without any client that gives the consent. So on our platform, there's a consent button that horse owners can click to share information or to enter any event.
So many people, and this is the last question, would say, all well and good, it's a good idea. But I would suggest to you, Johan, that in industries like agriculture and veterinary care, digital tools often fail because professionals, in other words, the people you're trying to reach, simply don't adopt them. How are you going to drive buy-in from event organizers, insurers, and vets to make sure that this doesn't just become another unused app?
So, Jeremy, yet again, I do think and I know that vets at the moment need something like that. We integrate with vet systems. Not only does our insurance product pay for veterinary cost, and that will make it for the vet more affordable, knowing that their cost is taken care of with horse owners that have insurance with GiddyUp. Being said that, is that all costs basically will be paid to the vet when the horses gets to the vet for any procedure. That makes it simpler. And then at the ease of use, all those records is automatically on our app digitally for the owner. And should they sell the horse, there is track record of such.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out in the community. Johan Roo, thank you very much indeed. Consult by Momentum Boskop. I appreciate your time. And that's where we are going to leave it for this Wednesday. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.